Cunningham for another extraordinary message on Gill Athletics Connections.
All right, here we go. Back on the Gill Athletics Connections podcast. So grateful, as always, really just humble that you'd press play once again on our podcast and check out another amazing coach from around the country. Hopefully you've been catching up here in season five. We started off with the Baylor 4x4 series. We've had some awesome people like James Thomas over at Oklahoma. We even had a race walker on the show. I didn't think we'd ever have that, and I really learned a lot. And if you weren't able to go to check out that episode, I really encourage you, even if you have anti-race walking thoughts, I'd really encourage you to go listen to Michael Roth from the Raleigh Walkers and learn a little bit about the event. And we had a really great conversation about where that event maybe should sit inside of track and field, or maybe outside of track and field. So there's my preview of what we've been doing in season five. I hope you've been following along and having a good time. And of course, big back catalog, 200 plus coaches here. And we're going to add one today. Help me welcome the distance coach of Art U, not our first coach, not our second coach, but actually our third coach from RU. We're going to learn about this really awesome university, amazing athletic program. Help me welcome the distance coach, the wise, the wonderful Mr. Bruce Jackson. Bruce, how are you, sir?
I'm good. Thank you for having me on here. Appreciate it.
It's always awkward to sit through the intro, isn't it? You're like, all right, when's it going to get to me? Yeah, it's cool. Race walking, Mike? Come on, let's go. We're talking about distance racing, not race walking here today.
I was interested. I wanted to hear what you had to say.
Yeah. Hey, I don't know. I'm going to put you on the spot here. Did you get it? Yeah, you're a listener. Thank you, by the way, Bruce, for being here and for being a listener. Did you get a chance? It was real recent for when we're recording this, to listen to the race walker, Michael Roth.
No, I haven't, but I've had experience. Tim Siemens over down at Cuyamaca College. Him and I are very good buddies. I used to coach in San Diego, and obviously his wife is national level. I actually got to see Tim this last weekend for a meet. So I used to have him come out to my teams actually and talk to them to recruit some kids for his college. So absolutely. I'm familiar a little bit with the race walking.
I was blown away. I told him even on air, but before air, I was like, hey, I'd like to have a conversation about race walking, and I don't want it to be confrontational. And the reason I said that was, first of all, Michael Roth, he's a self-admitted, he's a little bit of a hothead when it comes to race walking. Mm-hmm. And I was very anti-race walking. And I tell you what, I, no pun intended, walked out of that conversation having a lot more respect for the event. We really had a good conversation of where should it be for, like, the marathon is not part of track and field, right? But it's still part of our sport. So that's kind of where it's like, well, maybe race walking just shouldn't be part of track and field. It needs to live as its own event. Maybe there needs to be events, like 5Ks and things like that. And maybe it needs to be shorter as well, by the way. Maybe there needs to be a mile. And I know they're in, like in youth events, there's mile race walking. Because I was just like, why has it got to be 50K, man? I was like, I struggle with marathon. I struggle with 10Ks, to be honest with you. I know I'm talking to my distance guy here today, but
sure.
But 50K, come on, man. What about a mile? That might be a cool event, Anyway, well, Bruce, let's learn more about you. And although you have, race walking friends, good. That's really cool. Tim and Rachel, man, they're royalty inside race walking. So it's really cool. Well, Bruce, super excited to have you here. We have turned the corner in the podcast. After you get to 250 some episodes, you have to do things differently on how you get people to the show. When I first started, almost 5 years ago, first of all, no one was doing podcasts back then, really, generalizing here inside of track and field. And so here was Mike with this crazy idea of, hey, I want to sit down with you for an hour, hour and a half, and talk about you, your whole life, right? Yeah. That was a little, I don't want to say beg, but, I had to really coax people to get onto the show. Now, and this sounds like a terrible, terrible brag, everybody wants the show, right? So everybody's okay. So now we've turned it to where you have to be nominated to be on the show. Okay. And you, my friend, were nominated not only by a fellow peer of ours, a friend of ours, but also a Gill podcast alum, Mr. Lamont Vaughn, the head coach at Grambling State University. Dear friend, and maybe some of you listening right now are probably shaking your head because he's just one of the more most likable people in our profession. There's a lot of great people that are likable, and Lamont just really stands head and shoulders. Love him. But if you haven't listened to his episode, go check it out. In the same app that you're using right now, just type in his name, Lamont Vaughn, or type in Grambling, and that'll bring up the Gill Connections podcast. He was a while back. He probably was episode like maybe 80, and we're on this is 255 today. So, which, you know, to my distance runner, that's actually my half mile PR, 255. So it's appropriate. I couldn't even go with marathon PR now. I had to go real low.
Yeah.
So you were nominated. So congratulations. That is a big deal that someone else thinks enough of you and your history and journey in this profession. And I'm excited to learn about that today.
No, yeah, I'm very appreciative to Coach Vaughn there. And we go way back. So I appreciate him nominating me. And I'm sure his name probably will come up here a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, I was trying not to, because I was going to say, well, how do you know? And I was like, well, that's going to get in the story. Let's make sure we go in order. But before we get in order, I do want to ask you about something that you just taught me about before we hit record here, because I think this is fascinating.
Yeah.
So this is not your first podcast, and not because you've been a guest on other shows. Maybe you have, hopefully you have, but you actually host or co-host. You tell me, you actually have your own podcast.
Yeah. So I co-host a podcast called Blacktop Smack Talk podcast. And it's basically on basketball around everything. So, you know, mainly the focus is NBA, but we've dived into, you know, WNBA, college basketball. I've done it around for about 5-6 years, and probably we were a lot more active then. And I think, you know, as you get older, you know, some of my co-hosts is three other gentlemen based out of Seattle, and that's where I'm from. And so they, you know, they work out of the studio that we work with, Third Wheel Podcast Studio. There's a plug for them out in Seattle. And then I, you know, call in or zoom in, but we've done that for years. And so, you know, we're on YouTube and Spotify, Podbeam, all that stuff. So I have experience definitely doing that and being in your side, Mike, and interviewing different people, but in the, you know, the realm of basketball. So,
and you've done this 5-6 years?
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
That's a big deal. You know, when COVID hit, a lot of podcasts started and a lot of podcasts in the track and field world started. But as you might have expected, that when we got out of COVID and, you know, we got back to coaching and working and family and lives, as you mentioned, a lot of them fell off and they're no longer around, you know? So for you guys were pre-COVID, kept it going during COVID, and now keep it good. Bravo. That longevity, that consistency, which I'm sure you've seen in coaching, you know, A-plus consistency will get you a lot farther than a lot of tricks and gimmicks out there. So that's a big deal. Why basketball? We'll learn why basketball, but not track. Why basketball?
Basketball, it's my first love. It's what I started. I, to be honest, I never thought I'd be a track athlete in college over basketball. I did both. And so I just have a lot of friends in the basketball community, grew up in both track and basketball communities. So, those are kind of pretty prevalent sports in my family and just my friend base. So yeah, it just worked. It was kind of like our group chat, you know, exposed and people wanted to listen to it. And we just, you know, have a lot of connections in those worlds. So
has the podcast, because what I'm always learning is that a lot of people would like to do their own podcast. And I highly encourage, I actually encourage everybody, if you want to do a podcast, you should. Just like I would say, if you wanted to have a Twitter account or an Instagram account or whatever, sure, you should. There's no harm if you do it. And even if you do it bad, it's a big deal. A lot of people do social media bad. Trust me, I see it every day. But we would never tell them not to open up an account. What has the podcast Blacktop Smack? That's hard to say, bro. Blacktop Smack Talk.
There you go.
Has that led? Have you met anybody famous through that? Like that you've had on the show? What kind of opportunities has that opened?
Sure. You know, if you can just go the acronym BTST. You know, pod that works. We've gone into interview people from like, we've been, it's, you know, I used to go to Summer League before Summer League is now, like, right. I mean, I can tell you stories sitting with, you know, I've sat next to like James Harden's mom when he was a rookie, and, you know, I've met a lot of NBA different players and have definitely some interesting stories for another pod, but, but yeah, so as far as on our podcast, I mean, notably that would probably be more now that you would recognize is like Paolo Banchero, right? Who's NBA Rookie of the Year, All-Star. He's from Seattle. We interviewed him when he was like the number one high school recruit in the country his senior year before going to Duke. Wow. You know, so we've had him on the podcast. And then I more probably recent scandal, which has been this week, is there's been a lot of prop betting and sports betting in the NBA and other professional sports. And one person that's come to the kind of figure right now is Jonte Porter, Michael Porter Jr. So Michael Porter Jr. and Jonte Porter went to my high school, and I actually had Jonte Porter. So we interviewed him. So I kind of made a joke in our podcast, like, our interview with him might be trending this week since he's kind of the forefront of the NBA investigating him for gambling. So, you know those are a couple of names.
It's funny. I'm a gambler, and I just put a prop bet on how many podcasts he would be on. So I'm already up one right there.
You're up one.
That's really cool, man. I would, I give just props to you and your crew for doing that. It's, again, it's not easy. It's easy to start it. It's hard to continue it. So props. So if you guys are listening, you know what, so maybe some of you guys don't know, I actually teach a like intro to podcasting 101 college class for a junior college here in Illinois. And so I get to do a lot of the studies behind podcasting, and the average podcast listener, so you listening right now, listens to between 7 and 10 different podcasts. So that's kind of your audience. If someone's already listened to a podcast, it's easier to get them to listen to your podcast than someone who doesn't listen to podcasts at all. It's one of the hardest parts as far as the Gill Connections podcast is growing the listeners. Is we're now getting to the point where almost, air quotes, every person who's interested in track coaches who listens to podcast listens. So now you've got to go reach out people who don't listen to podcasts, much harder. Anyway, having said all that, if you are listening right now and you have interest in specifically NBA basketball, or do you guys kind of touch college as well?
No, yeah, we touch everything. So I would say there's probably a regionality focus a little more in the Pacific Northwest since we're that way. So obviously, like, I'm a University of Washington alum. There are too. But we touch on, WNBA, college, NBA, all of it. Well, even overseas a little bit as well.
Wow. Man. So if you are a basketball enthusiast, and I'm sorry, Bruce, I'm not, so I won't be listening.
Okay.
Usually I always like to listen when people do stuff like this. Sure. I can't handle it. I can barely spell basketball. But if you are a basketball enthusiast, I would go check it out. So the same app you're using right now, just type in Black Top Smack. I feel like I'm going to say something bad when I say
that. That's okay.
Black,
you got
Top
it.
Smack Talk.
Yeah, you got it.
And check them out, man. It might be a good podcast for you guys. I'm really proud of you, man. Like I said, that's... It's easy to start. It's really hard to keep it going consistently. So that's really cool, man. I love that. Well, let's learn more about you. I bet there's more interesting things about you.
Sure.
Let's kind of get in our way back machine here, Bruce. Where does track and field and cross country distance, where does that start for you in your life?
Yeah, for me in my life, that would have started in high school. When I started running track and field, I would say it was probably the secondary sport to basketball. I played basketball my whole life, pretty much since a child. And so I probably thought more of track and field and cross country as just like conditioning for basketball. So I didn't run cross country my freshman year of high school. It was more like, hey, we need that fall to get ready for basketball tryouts. And then I always kind of knew I would do track. It's been around my family. My mother did track and field, in like at the high school level. And, my dad's side of the family's from Kansas. And so like for them, they're all KU fans. And, my uncle went to school when Jim Ryan was there and the KU. Wow. And his daughters, who I'm really close to, my cousins, a lot of them did track. So we kind of, been around. So I always kind of knew in high school, I'll give track a try, but my focus is kind of more basketball. And then as I got through high school, got more serious. So,
and where are we growing up at? You said dad was from Kansas.
Yeah.
You went to school and up in the Seattle area.
Yeah, sure. I'm born and raised from Seattle. So my parents, met in Seattle and stuff like that. But originally dad was from Kansas. Mom was from Ohio. And born and raised in the good old Pacific Northwest. So
yeah, that's a great area. I really actually love Seattle. I don't get to go enough. I really do like that area though. Okay, so you're very common, right? We've heard this story 100 times from our basketball playing originalist is, yeah, I did it to stay in shape or get in shape for basketball. Yeah. I hear that quite often. Where did track switch for you? As you're doing basketball and track in high school, you've got potentially different coaches, a different set of basketball coaches and different set of track and field coaches. When did anything switch for you as far as, oh, I'm going to be a little bit more serious or did it at all?
Yeah, no, I think it was kind of a progression. What probably maybe switched and helped me a little bit was one of my basketball coaches, kind of the freshman level, also was an alum at the school that I went to. Was an assistant for the track and field team, but more the distance side in cross country. And so, I just remember freshman year, he was like, man, you never really get tired on the court or are doing like lines, like suicides or something like that. You know, maybe you should try, distance running or coming out to the distance side. And kind of my whole focus when I was going to do track was like, oh, I'm going to come and do like hurdles or some sprint. My mom did hurdles. So I was like, oh, cool. And my mom went to the same high school. So, I went to the same high school as her. So I was like, all right, I'll follow and do some hurdles. I think I went to hurdle practice, the very first practice. And then the next day it was like, hey, try distance. And I went out on a run and the coach was like, hey, just run with these guys. And it was some varsity level cross country dudes. And I think we went on like just a little recovery 5 mile run and came back and he's like, oh, did you stay with them the whole time? And I'm just competitive. And I was like, yeah, I just run. And he's like, oh, and I never went back to hurdles then, you know, so and stayed there.
Did that say more about your distance positivity or your hurdle negativity?
Negatively. Yeah. I think it was just more like, all right, like, okay, it's cool. I'm hanging with these guys. And so, I think, you know, I did that. And then, you know, I had different coaches and freshman and sophomore year running was still kind of, you know, for conditioning. And I came out for cross country sophomore year. And so just being around the group and it was just a different vibe from, you know, basketball culture and running culture is a little bit different. I say I probably got to junior year where I got more serious about it. And, I always appreciated, my high school coach, who and I are very close to this day. You know, he, I think he knew long-term that running was probably better for me as far as just athletic ability, pure athletic ability, but he kind of let me get to that point myself. Mm. He never was, the ultimatum where you've got to do this, you can't do that, which a lot of coaches are, tend to be sometimes at the high school level. Whereas my basketball coach is like, why are you doing this stuff? Like we need you at off season, you know, spring league ball and in this stuff. And my other coach is like, hey, you know, you'll come to it. And so I think probably towards my junior year, I kind of was like, you know what? I wonder if I like put a little more in running and maybe less in basketball, what could happen? Cause at that point, I mean, I had some minor success, but not compared to what, you know, the explosion that kind of came at the end of junior, I would say senior year. So
before we get to that, going back to, you know, I always like when people are telling these stories, I have a, it's an automatic, I just start playing the movie in my head. Right. And so, you know, when you talked earlier about, you know, at first I did track to stay in shape or to get into shape for basketball, that's a pretty common story. I hear that quite often. When you went on that first, you know, 4 or 5 miler, you know, recovery run, which probably wasn't a recovery run for you, you know,
no,
you were probably a little gassed. You were going to, I love how you said it. I was competitive though. I was going to stay with them. The other common story we hear with that is, yeah, coach told me to go on this 4 mile, 5 mile run and I never came back. That was terrible. I never want to do it again. But yet something, it hooked you a little bit, whether it was, well, you tell me, why didn't you like, you know what? I came out to do hurdles, man. I did not come out here to run 5 miles. What was it about that you're like, okay, let me keep trying this.
Yeah, I think it was just that the fact that I could come back, I think that appealed to me. Like, okay, here's the challenge. I don't think these guys think I can hang. And, you know, coming back and hang and then just, you know, the welcoming nature of the group. You know, I connected that group of people maybe a little more than the group of the hurdlers or something like that. And it just encouraging, like, it was just like, oh, wow, surprise. Hey, and I think the way he phrased it was like, oh yeah, come back tomorrow and try again. We'll try something else. So I think it just hooked up the, hey, this was a I saw as probably a bigger challenge than that over there. And then just like, all right, I'm pretty naturally and I'm with these guys. Let's just see what happens, I guess. So,
yeah, I like how you describe that. You know, when you think about the 100 meter dash, anybody can do the 100 meter dash. Does not mean you're going to do it well.
Yeah.
I would hesitate to say that anybody could go run a 5 miler. I can't. I can run 100. I'll probably still be running it while you're done with your 5 miles. But the challenge running the 100 is running it fast. You know.
Yep.
Now the challenge in the 5 miles is to also run it fast. But the first challenge you got to get over is doing it. You know, being consistent with it. So that's interesting. Learning a little bit about you there. Okay, so you started taking it maybe a little bit more serious going into junior senior year, and you said success kind of you kind of maybe a little bit ramped up.
Yeah, I ramped up. I just kind of, I just started training a little more probably because of a girl I liked on the team that was a year older than
me. That is also a common theme.
So I started running and who was more of a built for distance and kind of more of a longer distance runner. And I just kind of took it more seriously and was like, all right, I'm going to go on these runs with her and not do maybe as much. Commit as much time to, you know, spring like basketball and off season training and stuff and see what I could get to. And so I had a little bit of success my junior year. I think like, you know, I was one of the top guys in our league, which I mean, nothing, but like the league level, like the 800 and 400 meters or something. And I think I just remember sometimes you need disappointment to kind of give you a boost, you know? And so I kind of remember junior year, you know, I made state individually in cross country my junior year. And so it's my second year running cross country. And so, you know, at our school, we had a pretty good tradition at our high school. And so I was happy to make it individually. Of course I wanted the team to be there, but me and another one of my teammates made it individually. And so I had a decent state meet, nothing spectacular or anything. I think I was like 77th or something in the state meet. And, you know, Washington's a pretty good running state though, but it's like, all right. And then track, for a long time, I kind of fought my coach and I was just like, hey, I like the 2 mile and the mile. And he was like, I think you're 800 meter runner. And I was like, no. And so my freshman and sophomore year, I reversal. I normally just wanted to do the 2 mile and mile. And again, he was patient, never forced the issue, kind of always let me get there on my own and kind of show the steps. And so junior year, I kind of gave into him. I was like, all right, let me try this 800 and the 400. And I ended up being like the fastest person in the 400 in the league and was up there in the eight. And I remember scratching the 400 at league to focus on the eight. And I thought I could make state in track and I didn't. And I had a disappointing meet at the district meet and didn't. I think I had barely, you know, broken two that year or something like that. And you know, I was just like, oh yeah, I didn't make it. And I was just really disappointed. And I just kind of told myself, I just kind of remember sitting in the stands and it's a typical Pacific Northwest day. It's pouring down rain. I'm disappointed. I'm all sad and droopy. And I'm telling myself, you know, like this feeling I'm feeling right now, like I can change this. I'm going to try to put a little more effort in running because I've put a lot in basketball and I'm getting better, but I'm not, you know, there's a little more factors, I think, in a basketball, a little more of a team aspect. There's, you know, you have a little more control where, you know, track sometimes is, you know, as viewed as like, right, an individual sport in a team setting. And so I thought, you know, I can control a little bit more in track and field than I can in basketball. And so let's see what we can do going to senior year.
You know, I'm sure a lot of coaches are listening right now and, you know, they're replaying the hundreds of kids that have told them, hey, I'm never going to let this happen again. Hey, I'll never want to feel like this again. And maybe 90 out of 100, they don't do anything different to make that feeling not happen again or to make that result not happen again. What did you do differently when you were sitting there? And I kind of picture this, you know, the commercial with the rain cloud that's just following just you, but you have to do something different now for the next 365 days. So it's different next year. What did you do different?
Yeah, no, I stuck to my guns. You know, I, you know, that summer and all that, I was committed to the team and obviously had friends and players as far as basketball, but like summer league ball, I tried to like kind of minimize just how much I was around basketball and turned that into running. So I just like, trained that summer, trained like I had actually, hey, and you come and do summer practices. But I think a lot of times as coaches know, sometimes people are just, you're going through the motions. Like, are you really, is the toe in there? Or are you really dived into the lake? And so I finally stopped putting the toes in there and dived into it. And just try to make my life around it and really run on my own and focus on pace and really communicate with my coach. And and so that's just kind of the big change, whereas I just kind of shifted the focus. Like, yeah, I'm going to commit myself to the team because I'm one of the best, basketball players of the school and all that, but I'm, going to reshift a lot more of my focus on working out on my own and conditioning and all that. And so that's kind of the focus. And then, and then senior year was, kind of way better.
How'd it work out?
Yeah, it worked out well. I mean, I made state again in cross country and another teammate. And I think I had another disappointing setback that I wouldn't have had the track season. I wouldn't have had if it wasn't for the disappointment that senior cross country. And I kind of use that sometimes with my athletes about sometimes you need disappointment to write you. And so, I was one of the better runners in our district, I would say at the state level and cross. And my whole goal that year was to make team wash. I'll never forget this. Probably the only time I've ever, I'm admitting this in a podcast, only time I've ever cried at like a competition. But Team Washington, if you don't know, like in the Pacific Northwest, and I don't know if they still do it, it's called Border Clash now, but right. Border Clash is, or it was called back then, it was the top 40 cross country runners in Washington go against the top 40 cross country runners in Oregon at the Nike campus. And like, my whole goal was like such a big deal. It's like, I want to make, Border Clash, which means I was a 3A runner, 4A is the top, I have to be on the podium. And so all year, I had been finishing big invites, stuff like that, races, top 10, top five. So I'm like, all right, I can make this podium in Border Clash. And I had beat my teammate every single race all year long. And that particular year at the state meet, it was a windstorm year, actually 40, 50 mile per hour winds. It's documented, and they ran in it. And I'm a little bit more of a 800 body type. I'm a little more taller, stockier. And actually my teammate, I remember this, he ended up being a professional cyclist, but he had been cycling his whole life. So he understood the concept of like drafting, sitting behind someone. And it was a bad race. And like, I was up in the leaders the first mile and a half and just slowly just started dying off. And I always remember, I will never forget that. I remember there's a point in the race, if you run at the Washington State meet cross country course, where there's a point where if you're in the back and the leaders in the front, there's kind of a turn. And so you can see the leaders go by. And I remember at that point, the race is over.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh, there's such and such who I was with, last week at the district meet. There's such and such who was, right there in the league. Oh my gosh, my teammate, he's in six. What? Like,
you're like, you son of a.
I know. And he kicks it in and he ends up finishing fifth and the top guy in our league. And I mean, like, the dude was not, race of his life. Yeah. And he makes it. And I crossed the line and I broke down. I was sobbing and crying, like, oh, I can't believe that. I was happy for him, obviously, myself. And I just told myself, like, oh man, like, and so that was kind of the fuel, the fire. I was like, I am going on a track. I'm more suited my skill set for track. And I'm just going to go on, like, try to be a tear and really, and so that kind of just lit a fire. And, and the belief of my coach, he kind of came up to me with some crazy idea for the track season. I was like, wow, like, you want to do this, he believed in me, and we track was a whole different game. So
sounds like you've alluded to this coach, and we almost called the podcast the Gil shout out podcast because we love shout outs. Sounds like you had a really good relationship with your high school coach.
Very, very, Richard Freeman. Very good. I mean, to this day, I mean, he knows almost as much as my current team as I know about my team. Now that he's retired, he travels and he's come to watch, my team compete, like Brian Clay, Mount Sac. We're very, very close. We probably talk on the phone every 2-3 weeks, stuff like that. So
wow. What, I don't know that I hear that in other sports. I played other sports, you know, I was a football player and stuff like that. And I certainly, you know, keep in touch with a couple of my coaches. But you hear that with track coach. I mean, here's a guy who, you know, he coached in track, and that's, it's really important. I mean, no one's a bigger track coach fan than me, but here he is in retirement traveling to his former athletes now team. You know, I mean, that's, what do you think that bond is? Why in track and field?
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's so many, I guess, hour, depending on the, obviously, I think for everything, there's so much maybe one-on-one, just face-to-face interaction. I think obviously, like, you know, when I think of a basketball environment, of course there's that, but in a practice setting, right, a lot of times you're addressing, what are we doing as a whole group? What are we doing like that? And maybe with track, you do address obviously the whole team, but then you have to come up, because so many, you know, we might be a distance group, but this person's a steeplechaser. This person's more of an 800 runner. I think, I don't know, maybe it's just, there is a lot of just face-to-face interaction, maybe a little more. Maybe that's why, I don't know.
Yeah. I just don't know that if you to become a basketball coach, if your basketball coach would come down to watch your game. I don't know.
No. Yeah. I don't think.
And I'm not, that's not judgment on the basketball coach. It's just, you know, I'm just not sure. So, you are going through your senior year. You're having a much better senior year after cross country season. You have a wild plan Coach Freeman comes up with, and you have to start looking at schools, whether it's to actually run or at least for the academic side. What did, tell us about going in and thinking about the college process, and what did you end up going and majoring in?
Yeah. I mean, think after my, you know, things have really opened up after senior year of track, you know, I mean, the crazy thing he wanted me to do was do the Alberta Juan Terena double, you know, win the 400 and 800 at the state meet. So,
we
accomplished it, and I'm, you know, still the only prep in Washington State history to do it.
Is that right? Holy
yeah,
cow.
That's correct. Yeah. So toughest double in track and field. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, after doing that and dropping, you know, significantly my times in both of those, because now, you know, I went from probably getting, you know, junior college CC offers, and I was getting stuff for basketball, to literally, you know, senior year, here's a guy that thought he was a 2-miler, doesn't train like a sprinter, and now he's, you know, ran 48.4 and 154 off of distance training, and then I ran 47 this summer, you know, splits like that. So I mean, tremendous increase. And so I had a lot of schools interested in me, but a lot of them wanted me to go. And I think the biggest riff for some of them was, a lot of them wanted me to come and become a sprinter, you know, and it's like, this guy's running this fast without like literally training like a distance runner. And I didn't want that. I kind of wanted to be a middle distance runner, probably focus more on the 800 and 15 potentially in mile, and still run. I love the relay 4x4 and stuff like that. It was, you know, that process was interesting. It was really late for me, because again, I kind of gambled on myself. I kind of had a disappointing cross country season and wasn't getting too many interests. And then obviously my junior track, I didn't have anything phenomenal. I had ran like 159 and 51 something, you know? And so, you know, Titanic, but again, I was so undertrained, like I told you, and I took it more seriously and had this kind of gigantic leap, and made high school nationals and all, which was back then Adidas, now it's New Balance and all that. But, So, you know, my coach just, I didn't really, to be quite honest, I mean, I talked to a few schools, but like my recruiting really jumped after the high school state meet. So you're almost into the summer after your senior year, perhaps. So, I mean, I remember obviously at the state meet, there was schools and beforehand, you know, I would say the only school that kind of consistently talked to me leading up to that was like University of Washington a little bit. I know during that process for me, I really wasn't sold in going to school where I was from. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't want to go to school in my backyard. My senior year, we had a brand new track as well. And it's like one of the nicest tracks in Seattle. And so like my high school track at the time, I would say was nicer than the University of Washington's track, because they used to have the old track, the few that were around the football field. And so I was like, I don't want to go here. And so I looked at a lot of schools. I was, you know, out of state, and ultimately, out of the schools that some very big time schools that recruited me, I actually ended up at Eastern Washington.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The
Eastern
Eagles.
Washington. Yeah.
Yeah.
Greatest recruiting job ever. Yeah. But yeah. Yeah. So
interesting subject.
Yeah.
You know, thinking about, and I know track is a little different college-wise, scholarships and things like that today than it was when you were being recruited. But it's always interesting to me. I love how you put that. You bet on yourself. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of pressure put on me. We always have to remember, and I think sometimes we forget, we are dealing with 18-year-old kids. I really loved your story about breaking down at the state meet for cross country. You know, you're a tough guy. You're a strong guy. You've gone through a lot that we're going to learn and things like that, but you were still a 17, 18-year-old kid. That emotionality of what happened and what didn't happen, you know, your success didn't happen there, hit you in that moment. There's a lot of pressure on these 17, 18-year-old kids to make collegiate decisions in track and field. You know, this is where I live. And I see this I see this every day on Twitter where, you know, somebody will say, hey, if you've gotten an offer now, you better take it. It ain't going to be there tomorrow. If you're waiting for these, you know, power five, what is it now? Power five. I don't even know what we say.
Power two.
Power two. Yeah, right. Exactly. If you're waiting for the big time, air quotes there, Division I offer, it's not going to be there because of the transfer portal. I see and hear a lot of fear mongering with this. Now, I also believe that a lot of our coaches that are saying that are saying it. I do believe they're saying it for a little bit of self-interest. Honestly, but I do believe there's also the heart of, I don't want a kid to get screwed over here.
Yeah.
Again, knowing that recruiting is a little different today than it was back then, you didn't do that. You had some offers at 159 and 51, or you know, offers to go places and maybe some small scholarship offers or something like that. And again, I love how you put it. I bet on myself and you end up, you know, Washington now recruiting you, big, you know, big name schools and Eastern Washington. What is your, and you know, you sit at a Division II school, which that plays into this whole, if you get an offer, you better accept it now type of culture, if you will. Where do you sit on, what's your thought when you're talking to a 17, 18-year-old kid and you're making an offer and they're like, yeah, coach, I want to bet on myself? Or tell me kind of where do you sit now as a coach versus back then as an athlete?
I totally think of, you know, I try to talk to kids and I understand like what, you know, 17, 18 year old knows what they want to do with their life, you know, and exactly, you know, where they want to go. And so I, you know, when I make an offer, I'm trying to make sure that they know that, you know, you've got to focus on a couple of different things. For me, you know, is it a place, obviously you can see yourself running at? Is it a place that you can see yourself, you know, having the major that you want to be? Is it a place that, you know, when everything is not going well, do you want to be there? Because the last thing I tell recruits, the last thing I want you to do is look around and like, why am I here? Because I don't care if you're the best number one recruit in the country or number 1,000, there's going to be a time where running is not going to be going particularly well. School academically might not be particularly going well. And then you're going to have to sit down and look around your surroundings and like, is this where I want to be with some of the other things that, whether, you know, social location, environment, weather, things like that around. And so, you know, I'm a little more patient. I'm not, to be honest, I'm not a coach that typically puts out deadlines on athletes. Now, you know, I usually sometimes challenge them and be like, hey, do you maybe particularly, because sometimes nowadays I would say probably the difference is some of them actually have their own deadlines where I think back in the past, a lot more were just kind of like, because the recruiting market wasn't well as known, where there's just like, oh, well, I'll wait because they'll tell me what to do or they'll get a deadline, where I think a little bit more nowadays, recruits are a little more informed of what the climate is, you know, what's going on. With, you know, as far as like that, they're a little bit more knowledgeable as far as official, unofficial visits. Right. Obviously, you know, you get a little, I guess, in our sport, a little bit of NIL now and things like that. So they're a little bit more aware, as far as back in my day, it was kind of like whatever the coach told you, you know, you're kind of like hanging on them. So.
Yeah, that's interesting to me, you know, and by the way, I have a lot of empathy for the coaches who, you know, they're livelihood is dependent on 18-year-old kids choosing or not choosing their institution. So I also have a lot of empathy for the coaches who are like, hey man, you need to make a decision because I got to move on. I would just like to see more transparency of like, hey, 18-year-old kid, I'm offering you a scholarship. I'm just going to let you know, I have also offered maybe two others. It's first come, first served. You know, and that's also a lot of pressure to put on an 18-year-old kid too. I don't know that, honestly, you know, kind of talking this out right now, Bruce, I'm not sure that there is a healthy way to do it at all. You know, because we're still dealing with 18-year-old kids. You know, that to me is the smoking gun of it all. It's like, man, you are still dealing with a kid. That kid doesn't know what underwear he wants to wear tomorrow. How is he supposed to choose? And by the way, it's still, I've said this many times on the podcast, it's still ridiculous to me that we make 18-year-olds choose their academic and therefore their professional path at 18 years old. It's ridiculous. So what did you end up going to Eastern Washington? What did you think you wanted to be? What was the, I'm going to be a businessman, I'm going to be a teacher. What was the thought for academic?
Yeah, I think initially, yeah, when I went to school, I think I was interested in business and marketing, or the other side, kind of was into, I don't know, behavioral science and thought I might work for the FBI and track down serial killers and stuff like that. I was kind of into that. Just reading people and
again, why do we make that 18-year-olds make their decisions? It's like, man, I saw the show and I was like, that's what I want to be. And it's like, it'll change tomorrow. Trust me. Yeah.
So, you know, academically, yeah, those were the thoughts. And just, you know, athletically, they kind of, to be honest, they probably said what I wanted to hear. I can tell my mindset was a lot different back then. And, you have club coaches, you have your high school coaches telling you to go this and that, you know, and I can kind of remember, you know, where they wanted to. I remember my club coach really wanted me to go, you know, I want you to go to Georgetown. You should go there. And then, you know, you're getting letters from, you know, I was getting stuff from most Pac-12 schools and all this stuff. And, you know, I think for me at the time, I kind of wanted to be, you know, probably didn't say it, but probably like a big fish in a small pond. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Eastern just kind of worked with that. And they kind of were selling what I wanted to hear as far as like what I wanted to run. And so I wanted to focus more on kind of middle distances, where some of these other places probably wanted a little more emphasis on the 8 and 4. And like I said, I know it's wild, but you know, I'm the rare person that moved down in distance and not up. And so I enjoyed cross country and stuff like that a little bit longer.
I always say that there's definitely people out there that go down in distance because everybody says, oh, well, everybody moves up. And if that was true, then everybody would be a 10K guy by the time they were seniors, right? It's like some people do stay, and you know, you are the little bit of the rare bird that actually went down in distance. I love that. That's so unique. What, I'm always curious for athletes who have a strong relationship with their high school coach, how they transition to their college coach. How did that go for you as far as a relationship with your collegiate coach?
I mean, obviously the first stop here at Eastern, not very, very well, but,
okay. You gave us a little hint there that we're not going to graduate from Eastern is what you're saying.
Not going to graduate from Eastern. So, not very well. Didn't have it, you know, very good relationship. You know, redshirted my freshman year there. And, but again, I hindsight and I know myself and, I probably didn't help the situation. Sure. You know, I played definitely a part in that for sure. And so, you know, you're young, you got to mature, and I was definitely immature. And, you know, and I think also just probably culturally, it was a little bit, you know, I'm being in a growing up in a major metropolitan area and moving pretty much into a very rural era was probably a little more culture shock and just things like that.
Yeah. I don't think we talk about that a lot enough in recruiting. I think that's a good point.
Yeah. So, we didn't have the best relationship as far as my distance coach. I know, as far as the head coaches and other coaches were actually pretty well. And they were there for a long time, you know, Stan Kerr, Marcia Mecklenburg were there. And so obviously I had a different distance coach. So,
So where'd you go?
So after, 2 years, I transferred back home to the University of Washington and you know, probably, I always say maybe the best decision I've ever made in my life, maybe close to it. And a part of that was, you know, not, you know, just needed a different environment. I think it would just worked well being close to home. My mother was diagnosed with MS when I left college. So a lot of people actually didn't know if I was actually even going to go to Eastern. You know, we had kind of an incident right before I was supposed to leave, so I ended up coming there a little bit late. And so for me, moving back home, it served, you know, purpose was one, I needed definitely a change of scenery and to re kind of get my running career going again. And then also part of it was just to be closer to my mom, because I mean, literally became her power of attorney at like the age of 18 years old. So
I'm on kind of a crusade personally and outwardly to our coaching body of being more empathetic. You know, again, I keep saying, you know, we're dealing with 18-year-old kids. Again, they are kids. Even you may have been one of the more, and obviously you had to have been one of the more mature 18-year-olds. But, you know, dealing with your mom having MS today at this age and stage, you're a full born adult now, you know, you've got a lot of maturities, would be extremely hard. An 18-year-old dealing with this, becoming your mom's POA, dude, that's tough. That's harder than running sub 150 in the 800. That's harder than making a 4.0. That is real stuff that kids are going through, that you are going through while going to a whole different environment to live, new friends, where do I go to eat, cafeteria. Oh, by the way, no one's telling me to go to bed at 9, 10 o'clock anymore. So I can stay up till 2 and all these kind of things.
Yeah.
And having expectations of running fast, making your grades, being a cool teammate, things like that. That's hard.
Yeah. I mean, it was tough. I mean, she was, you know, and you're getting decisions. And at that time, she was handling it pretty well. You know, obviously, it's a deteriorating disease. But, you know, when I first moved back, I lived with her that summer coming into UW. So, you know, at that time now, I'm 20. I think I turned 21 that summer or something like that, but 20 years old. And so she was still living on her, you know, on her own. But you can see, you know, things deteriorating and stuff like that. And so, yeah, just being able to help her with the decisions and stuff like that. And just with her health related issues, but yeah, no, moving to UW, it was, like I said, probably the best decisions I ever made. And then obviously being there, my very first year, you know, I met coach Metcalf and, that's my guy. I love Met. And, I'm a big Greg. And so, you know, that whole staff, you know, believe me, a lot of those guys, you know, followed me in the high school years and then, you know, obviously transferring there. And I just really enjoyed my time with that staff. The staff at that time when I first got there was Dion Miller, who I know has been on your show.
Yeah.
Coach Miller, yeah. Arizona State. So Dion was the sprint coach. Coach Metcalf, obviously the head coach distance. David Bozzi, who, you know, to me is like a Seattle local legend. So I love Boz. And then at the time, Kelly McDonald, who's, you know, Kelly being now married. So that was the staff on there. And then obviously we had other staffs with, you know, other event areas, Pat Licari, yeah. Reedus.
Like yeah. That. So Pat was there. So, he's legend.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Rasmussen.
So you, you're getting into your last couple of years of college. You're being very responsible for your mom. You start thinking differently about your future. You start thinking about your future. It's not just what's today and what's tomorrow. It's like, what is 5 years from now? Yep. How did your mindset change at all in regards to academics, as far as what you're going to major in and what you might do? Eventually you're going to graduate. I'm going to become an accountant or a serial killer interviewer. What are you thinking?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think, you know, right when I got there, my mindset changed a little bit because it was kind of more like, hey, let's, you know, I come from a very high achieving, I guess, family and just like, and I think a lot of times I knew like, oh, you could study this and major, but doesn't mean you don't have to, you can't do something else professionally or go to grad school and get that. So like, you know, I was lucky to be growing up around a family that's very highly educated and, you know, I had people to look towards for, you know, success. So I think when I got to UW, it was like, yeah, you know, I still was kind of more of the business route in marketing, but like, let's, you know, maybe take majors and things that, you know, I'm interested in theory. And so I kind of like, you know, law enforcement or, you know, politics and things like that. And so I double majored in like sociology and law citing justice, which is kind of like pre-law. People either usually go into like government agencies or pre-law or lawyers, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, I was fooling around that idea. I come from a family of full lawyers. I have 6 lawyers in my family. extended. Yeah. So
I should have known that before I invited you to the show, Bruce. Yeah. You know,
so
I got to change all my questions here. Hold on.
Yeah. So I just kind of, I think when I got to UW, it was more like, all right, let's, you know, I obviously want to focus on academics, but I feel like I have a lot more to offer athletically that I wasn't really able to display at Eastern. And so I was just kind of focused like that, and I got the environment. And so, yeah, that first year at UW, I still probably had some of those, some of those immature things, some of those things that are lingering from Eastern. And that's why, like I said, I mean, Metcalf was just what I needed to wake myself up. He kept, you know, where I was from, I needed someone to be very honest and direct. And some, you know, some people can't handle that. It's probably a different coaching world now, you know, things you could say and do now compared to back then and stuff. And that stuff registered with me well. You know, he was very honest with me about what I needed to do and changes. And so that kind of gave me the kick in the butt. And so after that first year, in came Coach Vaughn, you know, Coach Miller I had for 1 year, and Coach Vaughn came in, and so we kind of shifted our focused training, and then things clicked, you know, where the first year I was kind of primarily with Metcalf, where when Vaughn came in, I kind of shifted down to the sprint group. And and then it's just, it kind of exploded and everything got a lot better. And Vaughn was definitely what I needed. He kept me going, and he challenged me for sure.
So I think a lot of people would be surprised. I don't do any pre-research for these podcasts. So I actually had no clue you ran as, you know, you got as good as you did your senior year in high school. And I really have no clue, well, how good did he get with Coach Vaughn? So tell us, because it's a weird question. I this might actually be the first time I've ever asked, like, so what did you end up having for PRs? Because I don't really care about PRs, meaning you're not a better or worse person because you ran 145 versus 245 today. But it sounds like, you know, some things clicked for you.
No, yeah, it clicked. You know, I kind of focused on that, and then, you know, for that. So then I got down, you know, he eventually became a 46.4 400 guy, and I was anchoring our school record in 44s, you know, which is still the school record to this day in the 4x4, 303. And so, you know, we just had a really good group, and especially of homegrown people, you know, there at that year. And it just, you know, everything kind of clicked, whereas like 4x4, except for one guy, was kind of homegrown. And
is
we
this
just
around
got
the
a team.
Jordan Bowes era?
Yeah. So Jordan was my roommate. I'm a little older than Jordan. Okay. So right before that. So Ryan Brown is like my very good friend who was, you know, 2-time NCAA champion in the 800, should have been 3. And so Amy Leah was also a 1500 meter champion. They won it the same year. So this is about 2005, 2006. 2006, Austin Abbott was there.
2005, did you run at Nationals in the 4x4?
Yes, we did. We did.
What place did y'all get?
So that 2005, we were the fastest team not to make the final in Nationals. Yeah. I got caught at the line by Northern Iowa, I remember, and ran 304. We ran 303, but that's the year that the collegiate record got broken. We're like all 8 teams in the final ran like 301 or something, 3 flat.
So my team got, you know, it's a lot of years now, so I can't remember. Yeah. We got third, fourth, or fifth somewhere in there. I was coaching at Mississippi State during that time.
Oh yeah.
So I remember, that's why. So someone, it's funny, posted on Facebook the video of that race where Xavier Carter, Kelly.
Yep, Lee, exactly.
Oh gosh. I should know the 4 bastards that from LSU that set the record. They destroyed everybody.
Yeah, it was like, I think Benny, was Benny Brazil?
Yeah, Benny was probably on it. Yeah. And I remember someone posted on Facebook, and I go, yeah, this was the race that got me out of coach. That was my last race I coached. I'm like, you know what? I go, we ran 301, 3 flat and change or whatever. Like, we're supposed to win. I was like, and we were fifth. I was like, we are fifth.
No, that
I was like, this is not fun, which is the ironic part is now you run 3 flat and you're still fifth.
I know, right?
You know, it's just ridiculous.
Different times. But I know, I actually vividly remember that because I remember like, and I was wait, we're going to go. No, but Oregon, Arizona State was in that final.
Arizona State, Minnesota. That's when Adam Steele and the other guy. I get older, I just forget all these names.
You do, but we were stuck at the hip, and so that's we were like, cool. Oh my gosh, I can't believe we for the first team out.
It was a dogfight to make the final. I remember that vividly. Yeah. I really do. So, so you have a much, I mean, gosh, you got a lot better, and you have Coach Vaughn, and you know, he's a pretty, I would feel like I'd be like, as an athlete of his, it'd be pretty cool. I mean, he's a great guy. He's a great friend. So I could see, you know, him being a coach. Career ends athletically, collegiately athletically. Now you got to make decisions on what you do. What do we do professionally? Do we keep running? I mean, you're a pretty good mark, so maybe you try that.
Yeah. So I just kind of, I think sometimes, you know, you hindsight, but I do remember graduating, and I do remember Vaughn, and my training partner at the time was Shane Charles, who ended up being the Grenadian record holder at 400 hurdles. He was all American, Pac-10, Pac-12, whatever champion. And so just kind of the natural progression. I remember Coach Vaughn asked me, like, you know, you've always been tall, athletic, stuff fast, more of a probably stronger, more speed endurance, probably 400 runner than explosive. Why don't you, want to try 400 hurdles? So I was like,
oh, this sounds like a, this sounds like a lot.
Now I regret not doing it, but I think sometimes you graduate and you're like, well, now I can do what I want to do. I'm going to run what I want. And so, you know, I always loved, like I said, that kind of distance and all that. So I kind of focused more. I was like, I'm going to focus on the 800. And at the time, you know, I was like a 149, 800 runner and all this. I'm going to focus on the eight and maybe the 15 and do that. So for three, you know, I graduated in 2006, and kind of my thought process was like, you know, obviously I always valued education, just obviously for my family and being, and I know, you know, I wasn't one of those people like, I'm going to chase this forever. You know, I know reality. So I kind of just was like, all right, I'm going to do this to the 08 trials. That's kind of was my mindset, was like, I'm going to do this. And so I went back, and I actually got coached by my high school coach. So I went back to him, since I'm in Seattle now, and went back and trained with him. And I joined, you know, a local club, Club Northwest. And they kind of had like kind of elite division where people were getting sponsored by, like, you know, Brooks or something back at the time. And so that was kind of, and a lot of like kind of UW post, you know, alums would kind of do that, a little bit of that route if they stayed in the Seattle area. So, you know, that's what I did. And I just kind of, you know, focused on that and trying to make, you know, the trials, which I didn't end up making, but, you know, made some USA indoors meets, and club nationals, won that one year, and just kind of traveled to the US and kind of did the whole post-collegiate thing for about 3 years and did that.
So on our podcast here, Bruce, we focus on coaches and their journeys. Somewhere coaching had to start from.
Yeah.
Where does coaching begin here?
So coaching. Yeah. It was just like in 2008, I was just, just randomly, I was on a run, and I used to live right by Woodland Park, which is right by Green Lake. If you've been to Seattle, and Green Lake's like the running kind of Mecca area of Seattle. And so I was just literally on a run, and one of my old youth club coaches from back in the high school days, Jim Neff from Rain City Flyers. And he's just, there's a dirt track over next to Green Lake, and I'm just running, and the little kids are, you know, running, and he sees me, and he's just kind of yells at me, hey, you know, how do you, want to help out? And I'm just like, sure, I'll help out. And he's like, at the local high school, he also coached at Roseville High School. And I was like, all right. And he's like, yeah, I'll just give me a call or text. And so I did. And he ended up hiring me as the sprint coach that year of 2008 at Roosevelt High School. And that's where it began.
Yeah. As the sprint coach.
Yeah. As the sprint, I was the sprint coach. And then I, you know, helped him out with the middle distance, but he was, you know, primarily the distance coach, and he needed he needed some extra helping hands. And, you know, I've ran obviously the four and the two a little bit, and up. So it's just like, hey, help coach these sprinters, and then you can, you know, help me out with the milers and 800 kilos. Like, all right, sure.
So what's your memory? You know, it's always interesting to me when an athlete, especially an athlete of your caliber who did it, you did it for a long time and then did it past collegiately as well. I mean, that just, you know, those are, you know, master thesis type years at that point. When you change over from athlete to coach, it's different. I don't care how high level of an athlete, and what I mean high level, not necessarily your times, but how much you really listen to coach and ask coach, well, why are we doing this workout and this, not this workout, those kind of things. So, you know, how much you actually paid attention to it. Most athletes don't. Most athletes say 4x200. Okay, let's go. You know, they don't ask about why and what systems are being worked, but now you're on the coaching side, meaning you've got to know why you're doing workouts. What's your memory of that first year of actually direct, you know, now it's Coach Jackson, not Bruce the athlete.
Yeah. It was interesting because like some of those kids, you know, I might know they're like, knew their upper older siblings who maybe ran club with me or something like that. So, you know, you're young. I mean, at that time when I started, I was 24. And so, yeah, it was just tough just trying to, and I think a lot of new coaches, you right, you just kind of think of like, well, what did I do back then? Mm-hmm. Like, what are some of the workouts that I did? And so, and then obviously I had Jim as a resource who had been around the game for a long time. So just like, programming, you're just sometimes it's just trial by error, right? Trial by fire, see what this does. But I just kind of thought to myself, like, you know, what did I want? You know, I think young people can tell if you're authentic or disingenuous, regardless. They're willing to do whatever, even if they know maybe you might be the most knowledgeable or something like that. But they will work for you if they can, they know that you care, Amen. You know. And so for me, it was just about relationships. And that's, you know, something I always learned from my high school coach. Ultimately, it's about relationship and how do we make these people better people? It's not necessarily better runners, but just better people in general. Mm-hmm. And so just showing them that I could care and I was going to, you know, if I didn't know something or I wasn't skilled, I was going to go read about it or ask someone about it or, you know, pick their brain about it. And so, you know, I just remember, yeah, that first year, yeah, the programming, I think of some of the things we did, oh, you know, probably not the best, but I think, you know, they performed because they could tell I was bought in and it wasn't just like, I'm showing up here to get, you know, some chump change or something right. like that. So,
yeah, I think it's, I always take it as a real big sign of a coach when they say, oh man, the first year or two that I coached, I look back on, you know, I need to apologize to them. Like, oh man, I take that as a sign of a good coach. Cause that means you have developed to learn more and become a better coach where, you know, other people are like, oh, I've been doing the same thing for 10 years now from day one to day 1000. It's like, oh man, you haven't improved at all since year one. Yeah. That's not a good sign. So when did, I love that. And it sounds like you're someone who is coaching track. There's a difference between someone who coaches track and someone who is a track coach. Mm-hmm. Do you remember it could have been an incident. It could have just been a time frame where coaching hooked you and you became, instead of like, oh, I'm Bruce, the guy who, yeah, I help out track team. I help out. And like, oh no, this is my career. I am a track coach.
Yeah. So I would say, couple years later, you know, I like I said, helped at Roosevelt for 2 years. So 08, 09 season, you know, I kind of told myself, I think I'm going to be done, you know, and I was running during those times. And I said, I think I'm going to be done chasing the dream or whatever. And so, you know, at that time, I was just, you know, working at a shoe store and then I was doing some grassroots marketing for that shoe store a little bit as well. And so I was like, you know what, I'm going to go to law school. And so
of course, that's what the Jacksons do. I've learned.
Yeah. As the Jacksons do. And my family told me not to go to law school, but I was like, I'm going to go to law school. And I had an interest of being a sports agent for the NBA and in track, you know, and obviously I lived with at the time, like I mentioned earlier, Ryan Brown, and Ryan had made the USA team in 09 and had kind of an incident. There was kind of a dark incident with one of his agents who was doing some shady things with a bunch of athletes he was representing. So I just kind of thought, oh, you know, I'm in the track community. I know the basketball community. I'm going to go and a lot of most, you know, sports agencies have a lot of people that have legal backgrounds, contract negotiations. And so I was like, all right, let's, you know, I want to be around sport. And so this could keep me there. And so I went to law school in 09 out in Michigan. And still ran a little bit, that first year, but then the demands of law school gets like that. But I continued coaching, in Michigan and I, you know, coached for a club team, Michigan All-Stars Track Club, and then also coached at the high school and Ann Arbor Huron High School and ended up becoming the head coach there. Yeah. And so obviously law school is 3 years. So from 09 to 2012, you know, I did that and those were great years in the club team and just being in a different environment, you know, where you're working with some kids, definitely, you know, outside of Ypsilanti, socioeconomically tough, you know, where the track team meant a lot for them. And I think those years were very formative for me to see how much the sport can do and provide and give back, you know, to those individuals. And so I would say when I left there in 2012, Michigan, to move to California. So now I've coached for, you know, basically like four years. And I moved to San Diego and I was going to, prepare for the bar exam. So I was preparing for the January bar of 2013. And so 2012, that fall, I was like, I was going to coach, just try to be an assistant at a local high school just to, you know, just to like still do it, put some money in my pocket, but focus on the bar. And at that time, you know, I had an interview for a job, and then this is probably that point where it's like where things changed, you know. And I had an interview with and if you know the California high school running scene, track scene, and if you know San Diego, you know Dennis McClanahan.
Of course.
And I interviewed with Dennis McClanahan to be his assistant in at Mount Carmel High School in 2012. And we
while you're working on the bar.
Yeah, while I'm preparing for the bar. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So doing bar prep. And I think I met him in June of 2012. And so obviously you've got, you know, half a year or whatever, some time before the bar. And I remember we had an interview at like an Islands, and it wasn't even like an interview. Dennis, he can get talking. And it was like 3 hours and whatever. And you know, I'm thinking, all right, I'm going to be this guy's assistant coach. And I remember he calls me and he just happens to say like one of his former athletes, Sean Forehand, who actually used to run for like the Nike Farm Team or whatever. He went to Mount Carmel and he's like, he wants to get into coaching and he doesn't have enough coaching stipends for the both of us. And of course you're going to go with the person you personally coached in high school. And I understood, no hard feelings. And he just kind of tells me, hey, you know, there's a position open at one of the rival schools. They need a head coach, and it's Poway High School. And I'm like, okay, and you should apply to that. And I'm like, I don't want to be a head coach. I just want to be an assistant. I just, you know, I'm preparing for the bar. And so I don't think anything of it. And I end up applying for it just like, oh, whatever, like head cross, it's just cross. So head cross country. And he didn't have to do this. And
right
to this day, but I heard later on that he actually, and he's only met me through the interview, you know, stuff like that. But he called Dan Crane, the AD, and said, you know, this is your guy. Like, this is the guy that needs to be, you know, the head coach. And I was going to be replacing someone that had been coaching in the high school for like 25, 30 years, you know, Dan Scheidel and stuff. But this guy is, you know, head coaching material, not assistant, you know, like that. And he never had to do that. And we've had, you know, obviously battles, but I always appreciated that. And so when I started at Poway and I got through that first cross country season, that's when things changed. And I knew that, you know, after the year that we had with those, that whole team, and particularly those young ladies, that fall of 2012, I was like, I'm going to do this. So
what changed? What, you know, I hope it wasn't you ended up going to the state meet and winning the state meet, because that's it's not a tangible thing. It doesn't happen every year. You know, it's like you're going to chase that for the rest of your life at that point. So
yeah.
what was it semester, a fall semester coaching high school, Poway High School, you stopped the sports agency dream. You stopped studying for the bar. What happened?
Yeah, I don't know. I just kind of, the totality of things just kind of culminated that year, and just like taking over for kind of a traditional kind of a little bit of a story program, but that kind of had lost its luster. You know, just probably people needed to hear a new voice, and just seeing those kids and how enthusiastic I was, you know, such a different person, you know, coming background than what they had been in, and just that year. And it was a very good year. You know, I think our women's team made, you know, state for the first time in like 17 years or something like that. And very young group, and everyone was back, and just like the reception I got from someone from a place that's so completely different from where I'm from, just socioeconomically and stuff like that. And just like, I don't know, I just got to a point where, for me, just seeing how grateful they were, plus the experience that I had in Michigan, I was just like, I like what I'm doing. And part of me, what's important for me is like, money's not like important for me. Like I need to enjoy what I do and have some type of reward, be rewarded, rewarding feeling of that. And I can help others. And so, you know, I got to that point in the end of the year, where I was like, I don't want to get into my like 40s and regret why I didn't give coaching a chance, where I'm already working for a law office or firm or agency, and I'm already embedded in it, and I can't, you know, necessarily go back and get in. So now I'm like, you know, at that time I'm telling myself I'm in my upper 20s, you know, whatever, right at there. And so if I'm going to give this a shot, I'm going to give this a shot now. And I like it. And I feel like the effect that I have. So I didn't take the bar. I said, I'm going to commit to coaching now and start that journey from here at the high school level. And we'll see where it takes me, obviously, eventually after that.
Earlier, you talked about your training in high school. You talked about dipping your toe in versus diving in, just full bore, cannonballing it in. Sounds like you're at that inflection point for coaching. You've been dipping your toe in coaching, but it sounds so weird. What a great toe. Meaning, you know, you've been head high school coach. That's a big deal. You've been coaching kids, you've been learning things like that. That's pretty good, but you've now decided you did 3 years of law school. And you're like, nope, I'm not going to take the bar. I'm a coach. I'm Coach Jackson. That's going to be my identity. So what did you do to dive fully in? What does the next step of, all right, now I'm going to coach. What did you do differently?
Yeah, I would say like, for me, it's just like, okay, the next step was just, you know, leading the team. And then I became kind of the overall director, you know, coming into that season, I took over as the head track coach. I wanted that. I still am. I actually kept the old head track coach, who was, that worked actually very well because he didn't want that. And so he was a throws coach for us, Phil. So I thank Phil to this day. We're buddies to this day. Yeah. And so I completely took over the program. And then I just said to myself, like, if I'm going to do this, I got to get better. And so for me, I'm a very strong proponent of coaches education. So I kind of really dived into both aspects, whether it's the, you know, USTF CCCA side and USA track and field, you know, side. And so I kind of had a good stint of coaches education. I dived into, you know, working at running camps and just being around, just fully ingraining myself in the culture of coaching and just trying to improve my craft. And I really dived into it very heavily from like 2013 to like 2018, 2019, very, very hard.
So I would echo your sentiment about being a big proponent of coaching education. It changed my life, not just my coaching career, but my life. It gave me a mentor in Boo Schexnader, who I still resonate with today, even in the professional side of the sport. You did a few different types, and there's a, you know, amazing different options now with USATF, USTF, CCCA, as you had mentioned, Altus. Now, you know, COVID taught us that, you know, we can now really pick the brains of our fellow coaches that are doing really amazing jobs out there. What is, you know, as you look back, you took a real deep dive, and obviously if you went to law school, you know, it doesn't shock me that you said coaching education would be a big deal for you, because, you know, law school is nothing but reading and education. So, sure. You just turn it down to track and field side of coaching stuff, right? What has been the most, you know, you look back at all the formal coaching education, you've done, what's been the most impactful for you? Was it the USTFCA? Was there a course there? Was there a teacher at USATF? Was there, what's been the most, like, when you look back, you're like, oh man, if I didn't do this course or this teacher or this class or this time period or this peer group that happened to be taking the class at the same time, was there a thing that stands out of like, oh man, this really has helped me propel my career?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a couple of different points. I think you just, you know, I think sometimes when you go through it, you just, sometimes things get regurgitated, but I think it's more like what peers are there and just getting to know people and talk. And then like, sometimes there's points I can reflect where you like, I feel like, maybe validation, or you're getting there, you belong, you know, stuff very like valid. That. So, you know, I think of like kind of, I guess, removing up a chronological ladder. I do remember taking, like, for instance, I remember taking at Marion University, USTF level two education. there. And I just remember that group of people, and it was good. And that's where I met Diljit, because she was there. It's Cal State Stanislaus still right there, that transition, and some other coaches, and Jared Butler, who's now out of coaching a little bit, but he was at Butler University, but at that time he was at Bryant, and before that Wisconsin. And just knowing that, like, most of these things I'm going to, they're college coaches. I'm the high school coach, right. You know? And so just proving my, like, you know, worth or known, or being one of the guy who wants to present this, you know, the project or speak or answering questions or being vocal, just show like, no, I feel like I have the ability to eventually, you know, be at this level, and move up. So I that kind of stands out to me. 2026 was a cool time where, you know, now I've been through a little bit of coach education, and you know, I applied to the elite coaches camp down at the US, you know, training facility, and that 2016 was an Olympic year. And so that was really eye-opening, to be in kind of a small group, and me and, like you said, you've got kind of a mentor, you've got through this. And, I've gotten to be, you know, pretty, got to know like Scott Christensen pretty well. And obviously, you know, for me looking up, it's like, oh, you're doing this, and you're also a high school coach, you know?
Buddy.
And so, so he was one of the teachers for that class, and being like in an intimate classroom, it was just four of us during Olympic year, and where literally everyone was down there, except for obviously the distance runners don't usually go to the Chula Vista location, but being there with like seeing like these top sprinters and jumpers and going to practice, you know, that was, and being able to, you know, sleep and eat there, and like, you know, going into the Olympic games, like, you know, that was very cool and eye-opening for me. And then I think just when I got to the point where I speak and taught for a long time at this running camp called Runner's Workshop, where a lot of, different coaches, and they mainly are college coaches. And then you get invited if you, you know, have a, enough kids from your high school team, and just some of the brain trust. And so I would say some of my interactions there really gave me the mentors and stuff like that. And the confidence to know that I can do it. And kind of two people stick out to me, or three people stick out to me kind of when I've, during that time, because there's been a whole assortment of other college coaches have come there, and it's based in Idlewild. They do one in Idlewild and one in Northern California in Yosemite. You know, one particular time when I was there, when I was thinking about jumping to college and doing that, this is probably back in 2016, 17, Louis Katana was there. And, you know, he was from, at that time, I think he just maybe transferred to Oregon State or still was at Arizona State, but, you know, just having a lot of one-on-one conversations with him and being like, you know, what do I need to do? Like, you know, I really, you know, I love it. If I'm going to make, you know, coaching my career, you know, you don't coach, you still got to eat and pay bills, right?
Yeah, so
you don't coach high school for coach high school for the love, you're not coaching it for a paycheck or something like that. And so just talking to him and picking his brain, he was very, very helpful during that kind of time period of my life. And then another coach that kind of went there, who I'm, you know, really talked to and friends today, is Devin Alizano, who was the coach at UCLA before Sean Brosnan took over there and stuff. But at that time, Devin was coaching at UC Davis. And so with Drew Wartenberg was there and stuff like that. And so he would definitely, and he came similar to me, started out high school for a little bit and jumped to college. So just kind of knowing, hey, here's someone who's on the same path, that's been on the same path before me, you know, and kind of giving me guidance. And then kind of the voice, they call it the voice of California, but Tim O'Rourke used to be there. And Tim, you know, kind of the next phase for me was like, all right, you know, you're going to this coach's education, you're doing these things, can you teach coaches how to coach? And Tim was really good about helping me, you know, get out and exposure. And so he worked with the LA 84 Foundation. And so at these camps, he always thought, you know, you speak well, you present, you're really good at teaching these, you know, teaching the classes, these campers and stuff like that. You know, how would you be interested in doing the LA 84 Foundation? And so I did that for a couple of years, teaching their, you know, beginning and intermediate, you know, coaches training as far as, you know, sports physiology, stuff like that. So those people definitely, you know, helped me a lot in the beginning.
I love busting myths, and there's a myth in the coaching profession that high school coaches cannot coach collegiately.
I know.
it's crazy for many, many reasons. One of them being that a lot of the coaches that you find successful started out coaching high school. So just for that alone is crazy to me, but it's a stereotype that gets perpetuated that, you know, a high school coach can't recruit. They can't coach that level of athlete. They can't do the paperwork that you have to do in the NCAA or an NAIA, whatever, et cetera, et cetera. They're all excuses. It's exactly what they all are, right? You know, we've had many, many high school coaches here on the show. And let me tell you what, they all the successful high school coaches recruit their butts off in the hallways and things like that. They have just as much paperwork because they're teachers typically, you know, in learning NCAA paperwork, give me a break. That ain't rocket science. It's a lot of stuff, and it's definitely gotten more today than when I coached, but it's not, we don't need a, you know, a mathematical degree to do them, for crying out loud. You learn how to do the paperwork and you move on. Right. And as far as like not being able to coach that level of athlete, well, I'm assuming if you would even think about coaching in college, you have coached that level of type of athlete at the high school level, maybe not as many, because we're dealing with, you know, high schoolers. In college, you get to, you know, recruit. So it's ridiculous to me. So I love busting that myth. So how did, there's high school coaches listening now, how did you, not only how did you start coaching college, and was Art U the first one, or you know, you'll tell us, and why did you make that jump? Because it first of all, it's not always as green on the other side, you know, what's that grass? It's not always as great as you think it is. I remember, you know, I coached high school before I coached collegially, and I remember thinking so naively, I was like, oh man, I can't wait to coach college. I get to pick the kids that I coach, you know, not just whoever shows up from the high school that I'm at. Yeah. I get to pick whatever good kids I want, yada, yada, you know, and you know, coaching college now, and every college coach around is laughing like, yeah, you get to try. You don't necessarily get to pick the ones you want. Right. So how did you make that, I hate calling it a leap because that means, that sounds like I'm putting college above high school coaching. That's so not true. In fact, I honestly think high school coaches have a bigger impact on our sport and our society because if you're dealing with 14, 18 year olds versus, in regards to 18 to 22 year olds. But how did you make that leap, and why psychologically, like what were you looking for? Like you're a successful high school coach and had a lot more room to grow as a high school coach. Why did you choose to want to go to the college level?
Yeah, I chose a lot. I just, you know, at the time there was probably two times in my life where I was trying to make a jump to there. And so kind of the last time, you know, it got to a point I was there, you know, coached high school now probably in the second kind of go around 2018, 2019, you know, I coached for 11 years, high school. And, you know, part of it was just like, well, if I'm going to, you know, you get to, you know, to be honest, I get to the crossroads where it's like, man, I've been grinding. Not just, you know, at that time, man, I was a student, you know, I was a teacher assistant at the elementary school for special needs kids. I had been doing that I was coaching the high school in the afternoon and then I'll be honest, I was bouncing at a bar at night, you know, I'd been grinding for 7 years of three jobs. And so
you're not teaching, you don't have a teacher's degree. So you're not teaching, coaching. And you're scraping it together to coach.
I'm scraping it together. And so it's just like, so for me, it's like, you know, obviously I have other options. I could, you know, easily go back to try to do something with my law degree and
you got a JD for crying out loud.
Yeah. Being a little more comfortable in life, but you know, like I said, I'm about this life and I wanted to be coaching. So I didn't mind, you know, embracing the struggle for those years. And so part of it was just like, I guess livelihood too, like, hey, let's get to college and all that. But also, you know, I had built a very, you know, I would say a very good program, one of the better programs in California at that time, after being, you know, I was at Poway for 7 years and, you know, put kids all across the country and had, you know, state teams and all this stuff, national team type level teams. And so I just kind of wanted another challenge. And I had always thought, you know, it was always my progression. You know, I always kind of have in my mind a roadmap. And so I was going to go here and here and here and here. And so I thought it was, you know, it was time to jump, to make that leap. And so it was tough. And so I would say, you know, I applied to a lot of places and now, you know, looking back and stuff like that, I would say there's probably two roads to get to, get to coaching that are being a grad assistant is probably the easiest coming. If you know you want to coach right after you're done as an athlete, that's probably the easiest road. For me, it was going to be a lot more difficult because now, I have been coaching for 11 years. I'm in my early 30s, I have getting a grad, I have a JD. Why do I need to get a master's right now? That doesn't appeal to me. And so obviously there's the volunteer aspect of it. And so, I had got to a point in my life where I could take the, you're not dealing with a 21-year-old, you're dealing with a 31-year-old who's got life and things and bills and stuff like that, but I could take a financial hit. Mm-hmm. And so, my advice a lot of times to high school coaches that are trying to jump up is if you're a little bit older, you might have to, if you really want to be about this, you might have to suck up and take that financial hit and come on as a volunteer. And I know a lot of my peers, and maybe turn your nose down. I know a lot of them will, my advice is don't turn yourself nose up because you still have to prove yourself, and come in there and not expect coming in there with asking demands, I'm going to be assistant coach. I'm going to be head coach. I want this and that. Lucky for me, I never thought I was better than anyone else, even though I might had at the time a decade of coaching experience and training and knew how to program and felt like, man, I might be better than some of these college coaches in my area as far as developing athletes. I still didn't have that experience, my resume. And so I kind of turned my nose down and said, I'll come in wherever I can get in, and volunteer. And that's kind of the approach I took when to get my foot in the door.
Where at?
So, interesting enough, I actually was in 08. This is weird how things come full circle. So 2018, that summer I knew, it was time and I was going into my last, I was going to be my last high school cross country season. And I had a, very good group. And at the time, Tori Olson at Cal State San Marcos had become the director there, and he was the head cross country coach at Academy of Art, and he had left there and it was at San Marcos. I think I just knew, and I don't know how it started, but I knew Tori from, I think he recruited, some of my athletes in the past, and I knew Steve Scott used to be the director at San Marcos beforehand. And I knew Steve Scott from that camp, running camp that I told you about. He was always one of the guest speakers and one of the coaches that came out. So I've known Steve for years. And I think when Tori got the job, I think I kind of told myself, I contacted him and been like, hey, I'm just trying to jump, I know you're coming down here. I would love to be your, can I come on as a volunteer? Just trying to get my foot in the door. Cause I, at the time I was secure enough financially to just, hey, I just need experience. And, a lot of my mentors that I had from that were already college coaches were like, you just need college coaching experience and the door will open for you just from your own running background and what you've done at the highest level. Just get it how you can get it, somehow. And so that was kind of my thought. And so we had talked. So by that whole year, I knew in my mind that, that we kind of agreed January of 2019 that hey, you're going to start mid-year and come on. And I was going to be his volunteer assistant there at San Marcos. And that was kind of the thought process. And so I remember I coached that whole year. I even tried to kind of plug my, and obviously the team didn't know, I coached that year. I actually took the team, I think, to their cross meet just to watch, set up oh, hey, Coach Jackson might be next year down the road, help recruiting in the future. But, and then obviously I told the team at the end of the year, and I actually remember they, end of the year high school banquet, they, did the whole video and they changed the Poway logo to the San Marcos logo on the editing. And two weeks before I was supposed to start at San Marcos, my girlfriend got too good of a job offer in San Francisco area, in the Bay Area. And she, was like, let's move. And so it was just too good of a job offer to turn down. We had, we were living together. And, yeah. And so I called Tori and I was like, yeah, man, like I'm, you know, and again, I wasn't coming in as a paid, I was coming in as a volunteer, and he understood, I was like, yeah. And I moved to the Bay Area. So I quit at Poway in January 2019. And then, moved here with nothing. Like, you know, she's obviously had a very good job and, you know, right. We're good on that part. And, yeah. And so I reached out to, Devin Elizondo, because obviously he's at UC Davis. He had expanded now. He was at UCLA, but he obviously knew the Bay Area. And I kind of, you know, poked his mind, and I was like, give me the gist of every program in this area, like your thoughts, pros, cons, you know. And he kind of, you know, gave me his opinion from someone who's been up here for a while. And from there, I literally had nothing. So I moved here in February of 2019, no job, got like a job at like a local shoe store. And I reached out to every school in the Bay Area if they needed a volunteer, everywhere. Didn't care, you know, D2, D1, whatever, in the area. And then, you know, a couple schools responded back. Yeah. And go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I was going to say, cause the plan was you're there. Okay. Well, your original plan was to go volunteer. So, okay, now you're just going to be in the Bay Area. Yeah. The plan still to go volunteer. So I got to figure it out. So you did the hustle, you contacted everybody, and yeah. I'm going to assume everybody got back to you.
No, I wish.
See, I'm going to teach you how to do your podcast. This is how you set up the softball question, because you know the answer is no, but yeah, you sum it up like, of course, everybody got back to you. And then you get to drop the bomb and say, yeah, no, not at all.
No.
Yeah. How'd that process go?
interesting. yeah, you know, some people did, some people were like, oh, I wish, you know, and so I didn't, but, some didn't hear anything, crickets. And so, yeah, two schools got back to me, and RU was one of them. And so I just kind of did school visits. I visited a practice and just kind of realized, like, I thought RU was a better fit for me, you know, better fit for me and the staff there. Yeah. And I started there, as a volunteer in end of March of 2019.
Quick speed up here. So you started out as a volunteer there. I love, you're the most prepared volunteer coach that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I took visits. I'm like, bro, you're volunteering, get where they can, well, they want to take you. I love you. You're like, I went and visited. I want to see where was the right place. I love that. That's great. Do a little bit of speed up here. So you started the volunteer. I'm assuming they eventually hired you because you're now so February of 19 started as a volunteer. How long before they hired you?
I became the director of operations in August of 2019.
Oh, okay. All right, good. That's interesting. And now that's changed to coaching, to being the distance.
Yeah. I was the director of ops for 2 years, till August of 2021. And then I became the head cross country coach in August 2021.
Okay. So this has been your first full-time collegiate coaching. You've had a very extensive and successful high school coaching. You had, when you were coaching high school and you're meeting these other college coaches, and you had your own college athletic experience of what coaches do and did and things like that. How did, as you got into coaching and now you're behind the curtain, you're actually seeing everything that's going on, how did that stack up against your expectations?
Some of the things I expected, you know, I think, like the admin administrative paperwork, things like that. Just some of that stuff was my expectations. I think, just the relationship piece, wearing multiple hats, some of those things were a little bit surprising. I think behind the curtain. So.
Yeah, kind of seeing that it's not just coaching. Okay, you maybe thought like, oh, okay, I get the coaching part. Like I'm at the right workouts and administrate them. I understand going to track meets, things like that. I understand relationships. You know, the better relationship I have, maybe the better the athlete they're going to be. And just, you know, we're human beings, so maybe we should have a relationship. But then you saw the other hats. You saw maybe the, I've also got to be kind of part-time athletic trainer and academic counselor. And the schedule just doesn't happen. So someone has to schedule, and someone has to do a budget and met out the, you know, what equipment we're going to do or things like that. Recruiting mm-hmm. budget, etc. You started yeah. seeing the mm-hmm. what actually the definition of a track coach is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was there any part? So there's coaches right now listening that they're high school coaches, and they desperately, I was this person, by the way, and mine mm-hmm. was driven by ego, bad ego, I should say. Ego's not bad. Bad ego is bad.
Yeah.
Mine was driven by pride and ego to go to college, to coach in the college level. Was there anything, so there's high school coaches right now thinking they want to do this. Absolutely. Is there anything that you can remember? And, you know, this has just been the last few years here now mm-hmm. that it surprised you of like, oh crap, this was hard. And so I had to learn it. Like I had to go call my mentors. I used to call my mentors and ask them, hey, what do you do with this 4:30 miler to make them a 4 flat miler? Now I'm calling mentors and like, hey man, how do you handle time management to do this paperwork? Or how do you handle, you got to recruit that. I know my place would be the right place for them, but they are just stubborn. They think they're going to go to XYZ or whatever.
Yeah.
What stood out to you now as you kind of look back of like, oh man, this, I had to buckle down and really learn this.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I just guess I got worn up because I got to do a lot of admin, obviously, for 2 years. And so
the director
that
of
stuff
ops
wasn't,
is a big deal. Yeah.
Yeah. So director of ops. So it didn't,
that might be, sorry to cut you off here. You know, when you talked about grad assistants and things like that,
yeah.
I actually think if you want to be a college coach, I think instead of being a, you know, some people say you should be a grad assistant or a volunteer coach. I actually think you should be a director of ops. I think that should be you got to do a director of ops internship for a year.
Sure.
Uh-huh. See all the other stuff that happens, not just on the track. Cause we think, I used to think like, oh man, oh, coaching track, I'm gonna be on the track 6 hours a day. Yeah, 2 hours, I'll probably be recruiting, but I'm gonna be on the track all the time. No, sir.
No.
you have to be in that office a lot of times.
Yeah.
I think that, so I think your director of ops position maybe has helped you, not the X's and O's of coaching, all the other rest of it, more than anything that could have prepared you for that.
No, for sure. Yeah. So I got to, you know, see that side with, because you were talking about budgeting and ordering equipment and all that. So I got all work with none of the fun of coaching.
No outlet of like, well, at least at 2 o'clock I get to go outside. Nope, not at all.
Yeah. So no, I think that's mentors, funny. You know, things I've reached out that's just been, you know, handling situation, you know, you wear a lot more hats. And it's like, I think in the past, I didn't realize when you're in high school and issues come up, you don't realize that like a lot of times you might not, that are all non-track things that obviously affect their performance, whether it's just something in life or things like that. It might not come across your bow because ultimately in the end of the day, right, they go home. Sometimes obviously they go home to mom and mom and dad kind of takes the brunt of it. Mm. You've brought that kid to your campus. And so now when they have those issues, they go home and they co-talk to you.
Yeah.
And I think that was like the hardest thing of just like, man, I'm dealing with like, I'm sure these things have happened or these issues happened at the high school level, but I wasn't necessarily, not all the time. And some of the times kids, you know, I had the privilege, honor that the trust that they had trust to come to me, but now it's like every time, because that's where they're going to turn to is you. And because some of the times those issues are with mom and dad. And so I think that was probably the most starkly thing of like, man, how did how did you handle, you know, this, this trauma or this mental health issue or this situation, as a coach, because I didn't have to necessarily deal with, that in the past.
That's a great point. You know, I'm proud that, you know, organizations like the USTF CCCA and I'm seeing it more on the high school side, the Wisconsin Track Coaches Clinic, the Texas Track and Field Coaches Clinic, where it used to be not that long ago, you know, let's call it 5 years ago, 99% of the talks that were given were how to coach a distance runner to go faster, or, you know, to go faster, how to make a long jumper, you know, the technical, the X's and O's side. And now we're seeing it's probably, I'll be generous and say 70-30 is probably, you know, 75-25, where now we're starting to see how to be a coach and what that means. And so that's the psychology side of it. That's the admin side of it. That's the I'm gonna call it resume building, professional development side of it. And you know, that point you just made there, it hasn't been, I don't know that in 200 plus episodes that's been brought up like the way you said it there about the kids turn to you more than their parents typically now that you're coaching college. In high school, and you could, you know, you could be a 40-year veteran and everybody, all the parents, you coached all the parents of the kids that you coach now. Mm-hmm. And so everybody knows you and you're trustworthy and you're a trusted advisor. 16-year-old kid gets into a car wreck. They're going home to talk to mom and dad. Hey, I messed up. I wrecked the car, you know, had a fender bender, whatever. In college, they go, oh crap, what do I do? They don't typically turn to their English professor. They don't turn to their academic advisor. They go, coach, what do I do? I got into a car accident. I've got it. My mom and dad, I can't, you know, I bought this car. This isn't their responsibility. I can't tell my dad that, you know, they already thought I was foolish for coming across the country or whatever. You know, they turn to you. And that's just that's a small minor, like who cares, you know, fender bender. We're talking about, like, you're to your point about mental health and, you know, relationship issues. There's some really big concerns that they're bringing to you. And I would venture to say you are woefully unprepared outside of being, thank God you're a human being. You're a good human being. So you connect with them, but you're unprepared of like, what do I do here? And there's some of those issues are law issues as far as like, you know, I want to say first responder, but I don't think that's the name.
Mandatory reporting.
That's it. Yeah. There's things that you have to legally know about that you better be doing. And then other sides of like, you maybe just need to be a good ear. That's hard. Sometimes you're like, man, I'm trying to get to my family and you want to squabble about your girlfriend or your boyfriend. Come on now. I'm your track coach, not your psychologist. Well, I'm afraid sometimes 18, 20 year olds, you are their psychologist. And so you've got to figure out how are you going to become a listener if you're not a natural listener. I think that's a great point that it's not brought up, it's not talked about. And that's why I really love doing this podcast, because now maybe some people will have this conversation. Maybe some people who are high school coaches that think they want to be college coaches go, well, wait a minute, I don't think I would enjoy that at all. Well, then don't move up, because this is every college institution, by the way, junior college, the smallest NEIA school, all the way up to University of Washington, Florida, Texas, etc. It doesn't matter how good, how fast that kid is. They are 18 to 22 year olds first.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So we're running up into time here. Bruce, what I'd really like to know is, you know, I told you, I kind of, teased it at the very beginning. You're the third RU coach we've had here. So Charles Ryan, Chuck, we've had Chuck on the show, amazing guy. And now the head coach of the new Speed City, San Jose State University. We had, I almost said Lamont Vonnegut, Mont Johnson. Yep. who I think still holds the Gill podcast record for the longest podcast. I think we went close to 4 hours, which if you know him, that doesn't shock you at all.
No.
Right? Yeah, exactly. But I'm always, I was always struck talking to these two amazing individuals about the uniqueness of RU.
Okay. Yeah.
So give us kind of the 30,000 foot level for those of us who have never heard of RU or don't know the uniqueness. And then I want you to delve into how does that possibly change how you have to coach? Because it is a unique institution, a great one. I'm glad we have an institution like RU, but it is a little unique than down the road, UC Davis, UCLA, et cetera. Yeah. So give us kind of that 30,000 foot level of the school. And then how does that, do you have to coach or recruit uniquely because of that?
Yeah. I mean, the two things probably more that stand out uniquely than most schools. I mean, I think, obviously academic offerings, you know, we are the only, you know, art school in the NCAA level, as far as that goes, instead of sports.
Is that right? The only one.
Yeah. So, I mean, I always tell people like every university obviously might have an art department or art majors, but I'm talking about as the whole institution itself focuses on, you know, the arts, you know, art fat. You know, and I always like to say, you know, it's a little bit, because people hear art and they see just assume, what is it, just drawing and painting? But no, right. So art, fashion, design, things around
film
that.
Filmmaking. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Visual and performing arts. So, you know, architecture, all that kind of graphic. So anything with design, fashion, art, fine arts, visual performing arts, you know, Arts University focuses on. So obviously, if you you know, you're interested in STEM, you know, science, technology, engineering, math, I pretty much, you know, our university doesn't have much right. offerings in those areas. But it, you know, as far as those avenues, so, you know, that's one thing I would say, you know, makes it a little bit unique. And then obviously, being, and there's some universities that are like this, but, you know, being more of an urban campus, you know, where our, I always say our campus is kind of more of like a European, how schools are in Europe, where it's more integrated into the city. So, you know, we have buildings kind of throughout the Union Square downtown area. So obviously, you know, if you walk it out one of our buildings, you know, you will see faculty, administrator, staff, your peers that are, you know, that are art use, you know, based, but you're also going to just see regular citizens of San Francisco, you know, what, young, old, green, white, whatever, you know, roaming the streets. And so I would say those two things, you know, the academics and the kind of the location of us, you know, makes us a little more unique.
So when you're recruiting, you get a questionnaire back, or maybe, you know, probably because you're so specialized academically, maybe the first question you're asking when you talk to a recruit or a recruit's coach or a parent is, hey, so what are you interested in majoring? And if it's like, oh yeah, you know, my whole family's been engineers, and my other side of my family's been lawyers, so I'm going to go into some kind of, you know, engineering or, you know, that kind of, it's like, oh, cool, man. Good luck, and you just move on, or?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you do have those. Sometimes there's certain things around it. You know, some things go hand in hand. It's funny, actually, you mentioned engineering, you know, and so you've got the people that build, you know, the building, but you also have the engineering side, but you have the people that design the building, right? And so I can come at them at our architecture, you know, our interior, you know. Yeah, so sometimes you can think about a little bit and things like that. But yeah, recruiting, that is definitely, you know, one of the biggest things is like, what's the academic fit, for you here? That definitely does come up for sure.
So in the business world and all businesses, and even in podcasting, you know, they have what's called the ideal customer profile. It actually goes all the way back to Coke did this back in that they're kind of the ones that first one did it as a, and it's now become mainstream, is they had their people say, who is the ideal, I think they were doing Diet Coke maybe at the time, who is the ideal person who drinks that Coke? Like, who's this targeted to? And I'm talking about, you get real specific. Like, so they came up with Mary. I'm probably making it, I don't know what they actually came up with, but, you know, it's Mary, who's a suburban, you know, married woman, you know, typically has a dog and, you know, two kids. And so now when you make decisions of where you're going to spend your marketing dollars, your advertising dollars, and your salesperson people's time, you better be keeping Mary in mind, because that's, you may also get Bruce also might be a Diet Coke drinker, but Bruce is drinking a Diet Coke once a month. Mary's drinking five a day. That's your main customer, right? So same thing in your podcast world. If you think about your podcast, the Blacktop Smack Tussie, I really thought I was going to just roll right off the tongue. Yeah. The BTST, I think you're right.
We'll see there. Yep.
You know, you guys have to think about, well, who should we actually, you know, try to market our podcast to?
Yeah.
Let me tell you, I'm not your ideal customer, right? I don't like basketball. I'm not particularly interested in it.
Yeah.
So, you know, anytime you could spend $1 million advertising to me, you are not going to convert me. But there's lots of people, maybe young African-American basketball, maybe former basketball player. Maybe that's your ideal. It's like, oh, if we put $1 million to them, I'm going to get a bunch of listeners, right?
Sure.
So are you, you've got to, there is a specific, and by the way, this is for every university. Yeah. This is why when a coach tells me, oh yeah, any university I go to, I'd be a great recruiter. It's like, but if you understand this principle, you will, but just because you have a good smile and a good gift for gab, you're not going to be a great recruiter ever, because every school is different. Art U has a unique type of recruit. Obviously, we know kind of maybe art, or I love how you talked about like, oh, I'm going to be an engineer. Cool. If you thought about the design portion, that was really smart. Like, as far as like, oh, I can help educate the kids. What is the ideal when you're looking at the top 200 list in America of each event or whatever you look at? Are they, you know, people from the East Coast with that are affluent, that want to be art majors and come from big cities on the East Coast because we live in San Francisco?
Yeah.
I'm making up because I'm kind of inferring that there's, you know, some of those are not your ideal. What is your ideal? Like, where do you have the most success getting kids? What do those kids look like that you had the most success getting to RU and staying and being successful?
Yeah, I mean, I think we, I mean, obviously we have an international footprint on our team. But yeah,
I don't know that that's obvious, to be real frank.
Oh, I didn't know. So, okay. Yeah.
Explain that a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think for us, yeah, we reach out internationally, and I think, you know, where you've been is a factor. I think, being in the heart of a city, in San Francisco, a major metropolitan area, you know, there's things that just come with being in the city, you know, that's different. And so I think those kids that, you know, can adapt to the city. And so if you're from a major metropolitan area, you seem to probably transition well. So we've always had interests, you know, I would say people like, you know, we've had people who've been from like New York, for instance, who've come across the country.
I'm glad you started with that. I'm sorry to interrupt, because what I really wanted to do there, I'm glad you started with that, because that's what I was trying to make a connection with, is I think the coaches of Eastern Washington and you made a mistake, because you, when you talked about Seattle before you started talking about where you went to school, you were like, oh man, I loved it. I love the city. You know, this is my place. And then you went to Cheney, which is the opposite. And by the way, guess where you went back to? Back to the city. You know what I'm saying? I'm not sure. I think sometimes we think we lead with the performance of like, hey man, this is a 149 kid. I don't care if he's from France or New York City or Eufaula, Alabama. He runs 149. I want him to get here. And I think that's why you left. I think that's part of, I should say. No one thing is the one thing. I think if you'd have went to Seattle, you'd have stayed in Seattle all 4 years. Even if you went to like Seattle Pacific, which is in Seattle, you know what I'm saying? I think that's an important part. So I think when you're recruiting, and I love this, shows your intelligent, your EQ of recruiting of, oh yeah, I'm not going to waste too much time on that kid that's from small town Alabama, because unless they somehow tell me they've grown up wishing and dreaming they lived in San Francisco, I may get this kid, spend a lot of time and energy and money on this kid, and he or she's gone in a year because it's San Francisco. That's different.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, yeah, because they're used to, you know, the urban concrete jungle, as you would say.
Different.
And then, you know, we, you know, targeted international. I think one thing I seem to find over the years is, and I know this personally from being at the high school level, and I you know, worked a little bit in PE, is like in America, you know, you've got some other things that have come up as where there has been a de-emphasis on like PE and the arts through education, through primary and secondary education in America, while it's a little bit more emphasized internationally, particularly in Europe. So we tend to see a little bit more, like you were saying, a little more, I would say, Europeans or internationals in general having more of appreciation for art, fashion, design, because they have had it ingrained in their curriculum a lot more than here in the United States. And so so there's sometimes naturally a pull for those particular students because, hey, oh, you do have those majors because I've been, you know, trained in that or stuff like that. And I see that quite a bit where they've been in civic curriculum, whether it's been like architecture, that's a pretty popular major for us, graphic design, you know, because they've been around that, but you don't see that. Cause I'll talk to a lot of domestic recruits and I'm like, well, what's your experience with whether it's portfolio building or these certain, you know, aspects, and when they have general interest in art, and it's like, well, you know, I draw a little bit on my own, or like, you know, or like I happen to take this shop class where there's tends to be a little bit more of a formal education for those particular individuals overseas.
How have you guys, I mean, and it's been, you know, it was before you, Bruce, and continues today. I'm always amazed with ArtU, because not because you're an art institution, you know, an art school. I think that's unique, and I love that aspect. I don't think because you're D2. I don't think this is why I'm so impressed.
Sure.
Because you're in the Bay Area, where you are, that I think is the hardest part. There, it's you don't get to walk across campus to your track complex and practice, you know. So you've got a lot going against you in that regards. You know, not a liberal arts school that has English majors plus engineering school and things like that. You're in San Francisco. You are Division II. So in regards to, you know, whether a kid wants to quote unquote go D1 or bust and those kind of things, but yet, every year I've been blessed to go to the Division II national championships for the past 4 years now, I think it is.
Yeah.
I tell you what, I see a lot of RU kids there, and I see the final tallies, and you're a bad year is you are 11th. You know, your 10th is a bad year. You're top five. RU has won national titles as a team. How do you, I love it because it to me kind of maybe gives, it takes away excuses from other schools. Well, we can't because, and we can't, it's like, man, RU has a lot going against it, a lot going for it. Don't hear me. Sure. I'm not bad mouthing it here now. so how have you guys overcome that and thrived in it? You really thrive in the uniqueness of RU track and field.
No, you know, I think it comes obviously from the top down, from our director down. And so, you know, just, you got to embrace what you, be happy with what you have, what you got, and embrace it. And, you know, he challenges us, and, you know, we got to be innovative and use, you know, think out of the box. And so it makes you coach a little bit more. Yeah. I'd love to, you know, walk out my office and maybe a track there, but you know, I've got to take a little bit of a drive, you know, over to the track, and that's okay. And so we just, you know, we don't harp on what we don't have. We just embrace on what we do have and focus on that. And if you want to be good, you'll just deal with that. If you want to be good, you know? And so, yeah, no, I think that's just kind of what the motto is, and just trying to get, you know, quality student athletes, obviously, you know, I mean, the coaches, we can do what we can do, but we're not nothing without the great student athletes that we've been able to buy in, you know?
I'm always amazed at the guests we have here and how they forget to drop the names they're talking about. You're talking about, when you talk about your director, your head coach there, Kevin LaShore. We got to make sure that not everybody goes, oh yeah, we know who Kevin is. Because I echo every sentiment you say about that man. I love him to death. He has done a great job of continuing in doing it differently. There's no cookie cutter. You just do it the same way. Every coach comes in and puts their own fingerprints. And I thought Kevin has done a great job of taking over the program and the coaches and assistant coaches and the athletes that he's has now and has had and will continue to have as well. Okay, wrap us up. You said something really interesting there, and I thought this would be a good way to end the podcast. You said because of those limitations, and we learn in life and art specifically that limitations actually blossom creativity. You would think like just a big wide open canvas, you can be as creative as possible, but actually having restrictions is what grows creativity. So you have these restrictions, some of these things, you can't walk outside your office and go to the track. So you said, so you have to think outside the box, meaning you have to do things differently. In the several years that you've been there now, what's been the most out of box? What's been the most like, all right, man, here is my challenge. Everybody else gets to do it this way. Well, I don't. So I had to go do it this way. You get to choose recruiting, coaching, workout. I'll allow you to give a workout, even though I told you you don't do workouts, travel, meet, qualifying. I won't give you a restriction in that, but what's been the most out of box type of thing that you've had to overcome and do and be, and had it been successful for you? I love people putting people on the spot. I was trying to talk a lot. So to give you time to think.
I mean, obviously not having, not having a track, I'm sure obviously like not, but I mean, yeah, not having a track, we've done things, you know, you've done workouts, hill repeats on the streets of Union Square. I think the one thing that's kind of had got to me in the past, but it's just like, hey, this is what it is. You know, we use, the track at City College of San Francisco. And so we don't own the track. We lease the track, you know, we use that track. And so sometimes, you know, some equipment things. And so I'm a distance coach. I coach the steeplechase. It would be nice to have, the City College didn't throw away all the barriers and didn't have a rusty steeple water pit barrier that doesn't jump, that's stuck on the guy's height. And it's been that way for a little bit. And so I've had to think out of the box of like, how do we simulate, you know, some of these things and waters and stuff like that. And without going to another, you know, obviously calling somebody using another university, stuff like that. So that's been interesting where I've, you know, I think it's made me a better steeple coach with like doing some things up plyo boxes and jumps and turning hurdles over and simulating things. And now I'm like, oh man, you know, some of these drills that we're doing, these are pretty good. Yeah. So I guess that's probably one thing of like,
I love that,
thinking out of the box that has improved. And, you know, we've had some all right steeplers. So,
you know, earlier you said, and you said it two different ways. You said, sometimes you need disappointment to give you a boost. I thought that was like, to me, that was, you know, one of the quotes that I wrote down. I really like that. I think kind of the same attitude there is, sometimes, you know, you put this, you know, you need disappointment to give you a boost. Sometimes you need to not be able to do something the right way. Meaning, hey, the steeplechase is stuck at 36 and you've got a bunch of girls that you need to teach steeplechase. All right, what do you do? So there's your disappointment. You don't have it the way you, everybody else, air quotes there, has it. Well, you still need to get the boost. You still need to figure it out. And I think having those setbacks, those disappointments, is, I think you nailed it. That's what gives you the boost. That gives you the creativity of, okay, well, I got to get her done. How do I do it? And then you get it done. I think that's what makes you a better coach.
Thank you. Thank you.
I love it. I love it. That's a great, I knew there'd be a great example. Cause when, I mean, I just know your situation. I'm like, man, it is so tough. You have every excuse to, you know, hey, we qualified one kid to nationals. That's a big deal for us, Mike, because we don't have a track and we don't have this and yada, yada. And it's like, no, man, one kid, I don't know. Your whole staff would be fired if only one kid qualified. That's never happens. That never happens at RU. So I love that the mentality of nothing gets in our way. We're going to figure this out recruiting. We're going to figure this out training, and we're going to figure this out competing. And you guys do a really amazing job. It really is. When I see RU, it's always just like, man, those guys, there's nothing fancy about them. They got to work hard, you know. Yeah. They got to overcome a lot of things. So, Bruce, my man, thank you so much. You know, it means a lot to me. You know, we ask for a lot of time to sit down and do this podcast. This is not an easy podcast to be a guest on. It's not an easy podcast to listen to. If you're still here, man, I'm so tickled. And we've looked at our stats. I'm quite amazed at how deep the vast majority of our listeners, people are really interested in the guests that we have, your stories from soup to nuts, from the beginning, from, you know, I'm going to do track because I'm going to stay in shape for basketball, to, hey man, you know, we're trying to win a national title here at RU. So super excited when anybody can give me the time to share your journey. And I'm really thankful. Shout out to Lamont Vaughn for doing this, because you know, my goal is to get every coach on the podcast, and I only get 52 a year, so it's going to take me a long time. So it might have been a while, but I eventually had you. But this was the boost we needed to have you here on the show, man. So really grateful for you.
Thank you. I'm glad. I'm happy to do it anytime.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again, Bruce, for being here, learning about RU and really his interesting career. I think, you know, some takeaways for me on this episode. One, I thought, you know, talking about the recruiting aspect, I think is really important, but also, again, I love busting myths. And so this myth that high school coaches cannot coach college, I don't understand it. I don't understand it when it comes from coaches who used to be high school coaches themselves, by the way. That always just kind of blows me away there. But I think when we're looking at hiring quality coaches on the collegiate level, I think we need to start taking the resumes of high school coaches more serious, not as a back burner, not as a, yeah, maybe if no one else pans out. I think high school coaches around the country are doing an amazing job. Go look at the results right now, by the way. But if they're teachers specifically, and I know, Bruce, you weren't necessarily a teacher specifically, they've got time management skills, teaching skills, recruiting skills. They're doing everything that we're doing on the college level just differently, just in a different setting. So, Bruce, I appreciate your story and experience with that as well. So join us next week. Hey, don't forget, next week, actually, so two things going on here. One, next week on Monday, we've got, it's Penn Relays and Drake Relays Week, right? So we've got Steve Dolan, the head coach of the University of Pennsylvania, for our Monday episode. We get to learn about his background. Hey, this distance coach used to be a decathlete. You think this distance coach over here should have been a 400 hurdler? Steve Dolan was a decathlete. So join us next week for that. And right now, we're in the middle. This started April 2nd. every day on the podcast, except for Mondays, because we drop our guests like Bruce here on Mondays, every Tuesday through Sunday from April 2nd through the end of May, one episode a day, we are interviewing a high school coach from every state. So we started with Alabama. It's April 15th when we publish this. So we're probably into like maybe California or Delaware at this point, but alphabetically, every state, even Washington, D.C., we are talking about their outdoor state meet qualifying. So how they qualify, you know, regionals, sectionals, some, it's amazing. You're going to be blown away. If you're already listening, you know how unique this is. Some are descending order list. We talk about what events they're doing. By the way, California, it's crazy how they qualify for the state meet. When he was talking about coaching at Poway, I was just like, dude, I was confused on the California system. So check it out every day, about a 20-minute-ish podcast, April 2nd through the end of May, alphabetical Alabama all the way through. I think it was Wyoming was the 51st because DC's in there. But I hope you enjoy that. So join us next week for Steve Dolan and join us tomorrow for the next state meet. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate you being here. Have a great one.
The goals to appreciate the coach, the ones who point people most. Every season needs a voice of reason, speaking of growth. Got a prep for you, carry the load. It's coffee to the soul for those of us who stay on the go. Proper handoff to stay in the zone. What you packing for the road? There's more than one way to the goal. Take notes, that's paying your toll. It ain't practice if your purpose ain't clear. It can't happen till you listen with both ears. You can't mentor without a mentor's years of experience. You can reinvent those years. Every plan's got a standard to live up to. And the price, sacrifice, can you give up you? It's a choice and a fight. Not a win or lose. It's not a ploy, but advice so y'all can make more moves. It's not about how to, it's all about why. You don't know till you know who you are inside. 6 million ways to tie. Choose none till we all cross the finish line. The work ain't done. So we learn from the experts. We all gotta put in the legwork. Gil Athletics is a network. It's all about connections. Put together for the profession. To every track coach could be blessed.